Calling the meeting to order.
You found one.
Found one in Riverside.
That bypassed the preamble today. Did you not hear?
We didn't hear you down here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Roll call.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jason Gordo.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Gordon Ford. Thank you. Jeff Grover. Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Yeah, do we have any announcements?
I have one. Just wanted to let you know that we will be putting the finishing touches on the RFP for the investment consultant by the end of this week. And we hope to get you, the due diligence committee, a copy of that RFP by either Friday or early next week sometime. So just be on the lookout for that. And any input that you can provide us, we'd appreciate it before we throw it out there.
Also, the intent to propose deadline was Friday the 20th for the financial auditor RFP that's out. And we received three notices of intent to propose. And there were the three I was expecting. It's not a huge field. So we did get the ones we were expecting. So we'll go forward with that RFP now as well.
Only one?
Three. We got three. I reached out to about 20 different vendors and three responded.
Which I don't think is unusual. I don't think that's unusual at all.
Any other announcements? Okay, moving on to public comment. Seeing none. Consent items.
I move to accept the consent item.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved. Capital prospects. For you guys. Okay. I bet. I heard some of the comments. Oh, we're glad to have you.
No.
Please.
Nothing there.
No.
That's the weather in Connecticut. I have a real problem with this. Global warming's taking the day off.
It's like you snoozed.
She'll talk about her fucking stuff.
This is a colder day than usual.
I can't measure it by us. I think it was -1 and the official that I got from all this morning.
That's a nice place to live. You don't mind paying the taxes.
You get the freeze and
pay. Here you go.
Yeah.
Freeze.
I think I'd sign up for paying the taxes for now. Thank you very much.
Good, because we need more tax paying citizens.
I'll look into it. Anyhow, we are very happy to see everybody again. It's a different time of year for us to come out. We're normally here in June. I would suggest if you're going to pay us an on-site this year, which some of you have participated in before, wait until like summer. Because I the snow that's in the front of my yard will not be gone until summer. It's just unbelievable. So anyhow, thank you. I will just mention administratively, which I presume is all lined up. The new fee payment process for communication between our office and your office is all taken care of, and we're all set for Friday. So I just wanted to mention that. I heard from you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Anyhow, so we're here for our normal update. You have the materials. We are proud to have completed 6 years of the relationship with Stan Sara in December. And very much appreciate the confidence you guys placed in us when we were first brought on board. We're very proud of the results that we've put together for you. Things are reasonably normal at Capital Prospects. Not much changes with us. Our team made a few things to bring you up to date on. On page one on the materials, you'll see our assets are listed towards about $1.3 billion as of the end of January. And I'm sad to report that the seven relationships is now six relationships. extremely meaningful to a firm like ours more emotionally than anything else. Our smallest account, which was a broad market Russell 3000 mandate, decided to move to Russell 2000, issued an RFP. I heard those three dreaded letters. Which we participated in, and in the process got down to the day we were going in to do the presentation. We were leaving on a Tuesday, and on Friday we got the call that they delayed the whole thing until December. So we are an incumbent with Russell 3000 there, and they decided they don't want the exposure on the Russell 3 side, so they have removed the assets. It was our smallest, they're not gone yet, we were just told this. It was our smallest account, about $45 million or thereabouts was the allocation. This is a trend we see across many of our clients is moving to spending risk budget in the small cap area rather than the broad market type of mandates. So anyhow, we're down to six. And you see the breakdown amongst the various strategies. This will now mean that most of our accounts will be small cap when this after this is taken place. We probably reported a year ago to you that we had been hired by Siegel Rogers Casey, the last point here. That program has not yet funded. They're still, they're having as hard a time raising capital as everybody else is in this business. So we still meet with them regularly, and that will get going. That is going to be a small cap mandate as well. Over to page two, we were sometimes asked kind of, you know, the range of size of the pension plans we work for, which is what this page designates. It's really the size of the plans and then what our allocation is and what our benchmark is. As I just mentioned, we have a split between the broad market and Russell 2000, a little bit of fixed income as well. And the funding dates are listed in the right-hand column, which you know, we're very pleased that our first client who funded us back on our very first dollar in 2005 is still a client of ours, as is everybody else on this roster, with the one exception that I mentioned. Page three is our org chart. We do have something to report, very positive news. So we've added a director of research to the firm in October. His name is Chris Jubasic. He's in the middle on the top up there. And we might appreciate it. It's our first name. He doesn't go by Christopher. We didn't do this on purpose, but we just put Chris down.
Could have gone either way.
It had to happen eventually. Anyhow, he's got about 8 years' experience in manager research at the Common Fund. He joins us from that organization. He's been on two more significant research trips already visiting managers. He's helping us with the due diligence process and overseeing both our funded, 43 funded managers that we have across the firm, as well as doing due diligence on new firms that we are needing. The other mention, I would just say Ashley Martin's back from maternity leave. She's the person who does the day-to-day on your account. And hopefully that was seamless for you while she was gone. And Karen Meyer, we've promoted to a senior research associate. She's been with us about 2.5 years and very strong economics background. Does a lot of the writing that you get in your quarterly report on the market environment and that kind of thing. So, positive things going on in that respect as far as the firm. We're still in our space, which some of you have seen, and, but we are up one headcount. So page four is just short bios, kind of what I just mentioned. And what I would say then is that starting on page five are several pages that you have seen us. They're in our typical update booklet that go over kind of our research universe within our process. Nothing has changed in respect of the way we do manager research, construct client programs, and oversee them. We would be happy to cover that again if you would like. Otherwise, we can go into the program review. So it's entirely up to you all. Preference?
Any preference?
Program.
Program. In which case, the material's all here for you to cut, you know, go over if need be, and we certainly would be happy to answer any questions. On page 12, it's a layout of a page you've seen before. I still, I do think this speaks to the power of the period we have the small cap value program in place, and the fact that in the darkest days of January of 2009, when it seemed that our financial system was over or near to over, that you funded, because what you hit was the recovery. You just participated in all of that. So I think the numbers, the actual dollars speak pretty strongly to that. So the funding date in June of '09 was $49 million. And then there have been series of cash flows, either monthly in some cases or in lump sums in other cases, over the course of these past 6 years, the most recent of which was in April of 2014. And then we end January of this year with $95 million in the program, which we all look at relative performance. We look at the performance statistics. We spend a lot of time on that, of course. But I think when you look at the actual dollars, you know, what that actually means, it's pretty powerful. The manager, we haven't had any manager changes since we last saw you. There have only been a couple, with the switch from Tent to Haber Trillix, which you may recall was a single portfolio manager moving that we moved with, and then that firm closed, and that's where we took the microcap with Pacific Ridge Bellevue on board in November of 2013. The allocations across the managers are in the box on the right. And I guess the only other thing is just to update you on Inview Asset Management, which we, you may recall, when he went through a period where he no longer had his SEC registration and he reapplied, and we kind of had that bump in the road kind of from a firm standpoint, never on the performance, but from a firm standpoint with Inview. We obviously are in continual contact with our managers. We have no concern with the firm right now. We did a comprehensive, I think it was probably 3-hour on-site with him in January of this year, and it doesn't give us cause for any concern. He's, Glenn Kletchka is very focused on, he strengthened compliance, back office issues. He made steps that he should have, and those are implemented and in place. So I just wanted to bring you up to date on that. Otherwise, we have no concerns about any of the managers.
Marilyn, what's the total AUM for Inview that they manage themselves for everybody else?
Total is $89 million.
Okay.
And we have 21 of them?
Right.
Yes, and we have the bulk of Capital Prospects represents the bulk of this business because we have them in many of our client accounts, actually, most of them.
So we've remained around that same proportion for at least the last year, a couple of years. Okay.
We're 25% of it.
A little less.
Because of some of the changes that took place in that period when he was recommitting, if you will, to the firm, he hasn't really been in a position to put assets on. His number one job is keeping performance up, which he had done throughout. We were never concerned about the performance, but he has spent this past couple of years nose down delivering performance in the portfolio. So he really hasn't been attempting to put new assets on. And I think that'll change now. He's got everything's very buttoned up in the organization, so we will be hopeful for him. And he's done a great job for you and for our other clients. Are there any other questions on the managers specifically? If not, Liz, can you answer the
program? Well, as Marilyn mentioned, the structure of the program has remained the same. Our goal with a small cap value assignment is to select a series of managers that give us exposure across the various sub-styles, if you will, within that benchmark. So the managers, each have a unique approach. I think we're pleased with the having had the ability to add some dedicated micro cap. We did have 10 was in the program, Haber Trillix. Their portfolio tended to be a little bit smaller, but now we have a dedicated participation in that area. So we kind of look at the program as a mix of some core managers, Channing and View, and we'll put Pacific Ridge in that. Surrounded by some more eclectic approaches, which are represented by Bernzak, Healy, and Walthausen. We think that the overall profile, as a result of the managers we've chosen, is a very well diversified approach. There is a bias towards higher quality. We have one measure here as an example of that. And although we don't design a program to have the characteristic of a higher PE to growth, we are pleased when we find that. So the forecast PE in this portfolio is lower than the index, whereas the forecast growth is higher. We believe that this indicates that the managers are able to find some very attractive values. That's what we're hiring them to do. And in addition, the program has what we feel is a moderate level of risk with a tracking error of 2.77. So that's the way the program is currently structured. And the next page is a breakdown by sector, sector allocation. And as we all know, the Russell 2000 value benchmark has a very heavy weighting in the financials sector. We have been underweighted in that sector throughout. That really hasn't changed. If you look at the top four sectors within the benchmark, financials, industrials, consumer discretionary, technology, they account for 76% of the entire benchmark. So the remaining sectors are much lower than that. If you look at the program's allocation across those top four sectors, it's 78%. So we have a very similar participation in the larger sectors of the benchmark, but we're underweighted in the financials part and overweighted in the industrials and the consumer discretionary and the technology. So the skewed aspects of the benchmark, depending on what's going on in the market, can have an impact on the overall relative performance. The next page just reports on the top holdings in each of the manager's portfolios and for the fund as a whole. I don't have any specific comments on that. And then on page 16, we have the performance through the end of the year and then updated for the month of January, all of the managers, and we're showing the individual years and then the cumulative periods. 2014 was a very challenging year for active management. We've certainly read a lot that's been written on that. And that followed a 2013 when it looked like the market was quote unquote normalizing and paying attention to underlying fundamentals and rewarding those fundamentals in a logical fashion in terms of valuations and all that. The very beginning of 2014 it appeared to be starting out with favoring more momentum related strategies, and then shifted to back to, which has been going on for a number of years, favoring more defensive posturing. And that kind of it was a very variable year. There was always something different was happening all the time, and so it was very challenging. But on balance, it was better to have been more defensively positioned, and that that had a significant impact on results across managers. The small cap, in general, particularly on the growth side, underwent a more significant correction, relative to the other parts of the market, and then there was a significant rally in the fourth quarter. So for the year as a whole, the benchmark was positive, and we were able to add 160 basis points, that's the gross number, because of a strong relative performance in the second quarter and the third quarter. So we did very well then, and that solidified the year's outperformance. It was pretty much the same pattern across all of the managers as well, stronger in the second and third quarter, and the first quarter and fourth quarter were more of a struggle. Looking at the program as a whole, from a performance attribution standpoint, stock selection has been the driver of our outperformance, and that was true last year as well. The sectors where we did particularly well were industrials, energy, and technology, and although we lagged in healthcare and financials, those returns were very strong on an absolute basis. Sector positioning was more of a negative. We were overweighted in industrials and materials, which were not stronger performing areas. And more significantly underweighted in energy and our utilities and financials. Utilities and healthcare were the strongest sectors last year in Russell 2000 value. Utilities was up 21% and healthcare up 16%. And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, as we all know, oil prices took a major tumble, and energy in the Russell 2000 value was off 38% for the year. So we were underweighted in energy, which was a positive, as was being overweighted in technology and healthcare. Across the managers for 2014, again, just kind of summarizing, the underweighting in energy was pretty much true for each of the managers, not for the year entirely, but over the year as a whole, that was a positive. And stock selection, again, was the driver. Keeley was the one manager with a disappointing year relative to the benchmark, and again, energy was really the key there. As we got into January and this year, some of the dynamics that I just mentioned continued into January. So we were about in line before fees with the benchmark for the month of January. And the things that hurt more were, again, underweighting utilities, which was the only sector to have a positive return in the month of January, and overweighting industrials. And the financials returns were under the that sector of benchmark, due mostly to a lower REIT exposure, which has been typical of this program. We did get some preliminary sort of month-to-date figures for February, and the program has thus far, for the month's over, very strongly outperformed the benchmark, and each of the managers has outperformed as well, so we're pleased with that. I think since inception, we've added about 390 basis points before fees. And again, as I mentioned before, stock selection is the main driver of that. Underweighting energy and overweighting consumer discretionary has been positive on the sector positioning side. From a risk factor exposure, we've had a little bit of a higher exposure to larger cap within small cap, and at times that's helped, last year it did, but that's been more of a negative, and the favoring of lower dividend yield relative, again, to the broad universe has been a negative. The search for yield continues out there, and that's one area where we've tended to be have less exposure than the benchmark. So that's really kind of a summary overall of where we are. We're very pleased with the way the program has continued to do. We don't expect all of the managers to be outperforming all of the time. There will be times that is not the case, but on balance over the longer term, that's what we've seen, and that's been our goal.
I think we've said that last sentence to you every time we've been in here. And so it's in writing on page 17. So we'll bring you back to that when, as and when, should we ever have to cross that bridge. The rest of the book, the next few pages, basically go through what was just mentioned in narrative fashion, and then we do our typical year by year of what was happening in the market and what happened in the program in bullet point for the end of the book here, and then some brief edits on the managers. Nothing much has changed there, but we're going to bring you back to that sentence at some point if we ever have to do so. Not this time, however, which is fine. So we'll be happy to answer any questions.
I have one question, probably directed at you, Liz. I noticed that on that page 16 that the Pacific Ridge, the benchmark is the Russell Microcap Value. We have several internal reports that we generate and we put out to the board every quarter. Should we be, 1/6 of the the microcap value and 5/6 of the 2000 value. When we look at the fund in the aggregate, should we be using that weighting scheme?
I think it's really the weights as you see them on the earlier page. The market value to the manager would matter on page
right.
12. Because Pacific 15? Ridge there's a method behind the allocation mechanism here in this table. As we said, there's kind of a core portion and then the satellite more eclectic portion. But they are 14.8%.
Yeah. just kind of approximate 1/6, whatever that proportion is.
I think, I see your question. That would be, a very valid way of looking at this. I think from our thought process when we put Pacific Ridge in there, it was help us get more exposure at the smaller end of the Russell 2, even though, and so you need, it's been very hard for managers to, have a large allocation at the small end, particularly since they like to let their winners run. Mm-hmm. And also, Burns Act tends to be a little bit more of a SMID, portfolio. And so I think from our thinking, just using the straight Russell 2000 value kind of makes sense for the program as a whole and each of the managers. But, to your point, that's a, valid way to look at it too.
Okay. Well, maybe worth just looking at both of them, actually, from an asset allocation perspective.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
They are definitely microcaps.
Okay.
Even their small cap product is microcaps. Okay. They're just little.
Any more questions? I guess with that, we're done. Thank you very much.
We'll see you on your sidewalk.
I hope so, too.
Thank you all.
Thank
it's good
you.
To see
Thank
you.
You.
Thank you. Don't do it yet.
Do you have anything else that you're going to do here in California? You just go right there?
Yeah. We're going,
Have a safe journey.
Somehow JFK was closed the night before we came for ICE, which we didn't really know where. So we got lucky coming out. I think the next storm that's going through now is missing us. None of them have missed us yet.
By a smidge. Yes, are you up?
What's the rumor? I like rumors.
Oh, we have. did we have a value added report?
That comes later in the executive director.
No, okay. But under.
That just goes along
part of
with.
Their,
okay.
All right, then SIS.
Okay, great. We have four reports we're going to work through, and we're going to start with the quarterly report, the Q4 report, ending December 31st, 2014. Page 1 highlights market activity, economic market activity at a very high level. As we closed out the year, we saw the trend of volatility re-enter into the equity markets. That said, the S&P in Q4 around 4.9% higher. Small cap equities outperformed, reverse trend. If you remember from last month, we kind of talked to the divergence between large cap stocks and small cap stocks. Small cap equities outperformed the month, providing around 9.7% return for the fourth quarter. One of three large headlines for the quarter, oil, currency, geopolitical issues. And the third bullet highlights the oil conversation, OPEC deciding not to cut production contributed very significant and to a sharp decline in oil prices that we've seen ripple through the economy, and more specifically the stock market and the energy sector for the quarter falling 12.9%. This has implications that I'll highlight several more times throughout this report. And really, please, any interjections or questions, please let's make this conversational. Some of this stuff is very topical. And
is that more politics or market? Push out the small guys.
Question. It's a bit of both, you think. The decision from OPEC is really fascinating. It's a direct hit to oil-producing, energy-related countries like Venezuela, Russia, and the United States. The shale boom that we've been occurring here, OPEC has basically said, well, that's nice, we're not going to fund your profits. We're going to make sure that we are not left kind of odd man out in this case. This story is yet to play out. And what I mean by that is, especially in the OPEC countries in particular, their storage, they've basically functionally stored all this excess capacity that they're still producing. And right now, according to The Economist, they're at about 80 to 85% of capacity. They're hiring trucks to simply sit there and store oil. At a certain point, there's no more place to store this oil. Flash forward to kind of the American, the US, we have a lot of very savvy companies that have hedged quite a bit of exposure. So we've seen this precipitous fall in oil prices, but yet to go through the bottom line, being that they've been hedged, let's say, into either this year or partway through the next. And some of these guys are playing a cool poker game, saying prices are going to rebound, everything's going to be fine. And thirdly, this simply the efficiency of production here in America is increasing to the point where even we see less cranes in the air, which is an economic indicator of productivity in the sector, their ability to extract oil is becoming more and more efficient. So even though there's less projects that are greenlit, we're still seeing production come through. So John, having worked actually for Chevron way back when,
one of the original oil companies.
What's
interesting is I can give it a little bit of history. So I worked in the oil industry for 9 years, and the last time I left was when the price, one of the massive price drops. And at that time, which was the mid-80s, the price went from mid-30s to $8.56. And so it dropped even more precipitously at that point in time. But it's kind of interesting just to see how you get these big shifts in oil, but they're, nobody really knows how long they're going to last. And I think that's the question right now is you do have, at least in the U.S., rational producers who say, okay, am I making money at the current price? If they're making money, they'll keep doing it. If they're not making money, they'll cut back production. That's what happened 30 years ago, is they cut back production and the prices slowly recovered. And what I find interesting is the laws of supply and demand haven't gone away in oil. And the difference between, they talk about this large overproduction of oil currently, supply of oil, is only 1 to 2 million, one to two million barrels a day is what I've heard, at a total annual production of somewhere in the 90 to 95 million barrels a day. So it's like 1 or 2% of excess capacity, which is to me is not a big number. And is if you could see that, what happens on the supply when the price goes from 100 to 50, people are going to think, I've heard stories about people are now going out and buying their pickup trucks and their big SUVs and not so worried about buying their Prius and the hybrids and things like that. So there's going to be obviously a demand reaction. Again, how that all works out, I think it's interesting. You talk to people, the drillers, they're the ones that said, well, this will, energy will continue to be needed, it'll grow, and that this is a temporary issue. As Nate was just saying, you've got 85% capacity? Well, is OPEC going to keep increasing as it falls off elsewhere? I think that's an unknown, as the possibility exists that, you know, so the U.S. loses production in North Dakota, does that come off the market and for good, or does, you know, Saudi Arabia take it and increase their capacity to maintain this overweight? So this could be short term. I think it actually could be a several year process as well.
The second to last bullet kind of attempts to provide an implication of all this, saying that short term U.S. consumers expected to spend the savings. That is a shocking headline. U.S. consumers spend their savings. But long term, the implications are, will this start to affect jobs? It's been a huge job creator. And if we see that to ripple through the economy, it's a big problem. So we're mindful of this. It's really going to show up in the high yield market, an asset class that we don't have exposure in. Oil, energy related companies represent 15 to 18% of that index. If we start to see bankruptcies come through that, it'll be felt. Like a snake eating a rodent, if you will. Hard to digest, and we'll feel a lot of ripple side implications as a result of that.
I think what you'll see in this, as if it becomes more of a, you know, a distressed market, you will see buyers come in, so buying distressed assets. Doesn't mean they're just the private equity and the venture guys, distressed guys with private capital. You'll also see, you know, the financially secure energy companies take advantage of their less financially, you know, secure brethren. And that's, if you go back, it was when Exxon bought Mobil, was on one of these dips.
Yep, we'll see consolidation happen.
So that's gonna, you'll see that again. What's the net effect of all this? I tend to think, you know, price of oil is down. It's down. Well, that's actually a good thing, kind of on the, you know, the economy in general. That's one of the things that everybody uses. If the price goes down, that's a good thing. You've got more money for other things. It's going to obviously have an impact on the energy industry.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
Two other themes that currency will hit on this as well, and it's also affected the oil markets. Falling globally, we see a strong rise in the U.S. dollar. Geopolitical issues contributing to the unrest in Europe, Middle East, and abroad. The emerging markets, they fall roughly 4.5% for the quarter, also highly correlated to the price in oil. A lot of these countries are affected very significantly, more so than the U.S., by the decline in oil prices. Real estate, this has continued to be a very, very strong performer as far as absolute returns. We see for the trailing 1 year period, when we get to as of January 31st, over 36% for the REIT index. There's two things that are really driving this, I'm going to talk to you. One, low interest rates. But two, it's the currency conversation. Real estate, specifically U.S. real estate, is looked at a lot differently by investors in, let's say, Japan than it is in America. The diversification benefits of investing in real estate as a U.S. citizen, there are some. But the currency and the real asset aspect of real estate is very, very attractive. And so we see these low core cap rates driving prices might continue even with an increase in rates. And so keep your eye on real estate. It's something that certainly will continue to play out. If you see very strong trailing returns above in double digits for most trailing periods all the way through a 5 year period.
Nate, are you talking more commercial, industrial, real estate?
Yes.
We're not really talking about homes.
I think this probably relates to residential to some extent, but yes, I'm talking for the institutional investor, i.e. the Waldorf sold to China, Chinese investors just recently with historically low cap rates, and then they leased back the management of the company for 100 years. What other property can one confidently say will exist in 100 years? There's not too many, but the Waldorf might very well be one of them. And so I'm speaking more to that very trophy industrial commercial property.
But really, cap rates across the board have been
very low. And you see that where cap rates are really low, therefore prices are really
high. Don't we own this building?
Oh, this floor.
It's this floor. Okay. county.
Federal Reserve, you think they'll raise interest rates this year?
Sell it.
So.
Lease it.
Well, yeah, there's always the talk. Now, I was reading, they were talking about now that the discussion will be on a monthly basis of whether or not they're going to raise interest rates.
They're going to draw, they're going to string us along.
Makes sense, Jason.
So.
Huh?
They don't want to show that.
I mean, you're talking about short-term interest rates too. And obviously that has probably a lot of more impact on lending than anything that's floating. But it's, a lot of this is, well, what does the longer bond do and how it reacts to shorter? And that's been a completely, you know, different story than what people would believe. There's a page further down in this report that we're talking about what's happening with rates, with interest rates.
I was at a conference 2 weeks ago with Ben Bernanke, and while he's not in office, he still has an opinion. And he would say that their posture of easing or having a very generous posture should continue. And so whether Yellen takes that path or not, we'll see. The market is pricing, is calling their bluff. They're pricing in the fact that they won't.
Well, is 0.25% really going to make any difference anyway, really? I mean,
that's a great question.
Yeah. And I would
symbolic.
I would say it's on the it's on the short end that the Fed can have a direct impact. The markets, as you get further out the curve for the longer durations, longer maturities, that's just generally set by the market.
Right. You can see rates rising. You see them raising rates, and the market actually take it lower. The market can take it down.
So nothing's happened. You know, nothing has happened on the short end for 5 years, 6 years. It's been at zero for a long time. And the 10-year has gone from anywhere from 5 to 1.5 over that period. And when everybody thought it was going to, obviously, well, we're at historical lows. It's not going to go lower. Well, you know, 6 months later, oh, we're at historical lows. It's not going to go lower. Reset, and, you know, it's continued to fall.
Just means you can keep your money in your mattress longer.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get about the same amount of return in my mattress. And
you think about it. Okay, in this current environment, there are really negative interest rates in some countries, where they will charge you to hold your money. Literally, you know, Swiss. You know, some of these, they will charge you to hold your money for you. So you give them $100 and 6 months later, you get 99 cents back, or $99 back. And it's
99 cents if you're a hedge fund.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we're through page one. We'll fire through it. Very important topic questions, and those questions we just hit on oil, the Fed, currency, geopolitical issues, they're not going to go away. We'll keep talking about them every month we sit here.
And there's some speculation now that the euro's not doing what it was intended to do, and maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing if it went away?
I think that question has been on people's minds since its inception. They recently announced yesterday that they've extended the situation with Greece in order to discover some type of solution, but.
Sort of a continuing resolution.
Kicking the can.
What if Greece were to be dropped from the eurozone?
Yeah, I think it depends who you ask, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Would it drag the rest of the group down?
You can see the markets probably would be volatile to that, right? Because you basically reenter a currency that wasn't in place. And so the markets have to adjust. Everything's relative. Currencies are priced relative. So you can see a significant short-term exogenous event, but
as far as the size of Greece relative to the size of the euro, I think it would be more in terms of, okay, we just potentially did something different than what everybody thought. And how does that affect their behavior towards things like Italy, Spain, Ireland, things like
that?
You know? So it was more that the Greek is so small, it probably doesn't really matter. It's more how do they react to that,
sure,
as how it might affect other things. It would be the bigger event.
One thing is, it's been about 4 years that this has been modeled and role-played in the minds of policymakers. And while not to say that they might have any more of an intelligent response, the sheer fact that it is something that has been thought through as a possible event has some potential value when we think about things in terms of markets. You can see the markets maybe spike up on some type of event, just resolution. Markets like resolutions.
Well, I think you could see those other countries, Spain, Italy, they could watch Greece go down the tubes, and do they want to go down that tube after it's occurred for 6 months? Is that where we want to be?
Right.
And that'll be a big part of it.
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask a question, since we're on the international topic. The international part of our portfolio over the last 3 or 4 years has not done very well, but now I see that the ECB is talking about lowering interest rates and perhaps embarking down a path of quantitative easing, something such that was done here in this country for the last 4 or 5 years. Could it be that if the ECB does implement these types of strategies, that maybe the international sector would start to look more attractive going forward relative to domestic?
Absolutely. I'll start first and just drive it home.
So you guys have thought about this?
A little bit. John generating the asset allocation model has really contributed to it more. But from a number of different things, the fact that you see these divergences take place, the U.S. went down this path, and now we're talking about are they tightening, whereas we have other parts of the world, the developed nation, potentially easing. They are, not potentially, it is happening. March, they'll start purchasing assets. And in fact, the way in which they are doing so is, many suspect, has even a more tailwind for the equity markets. Now, when we speak about equity markets, that is a lot different than speaking about economic productivity of countries. There is some correlation between those, but it's not the same topic. But as far as equity markets are concerned, this could certainly be an event to consider asset allocation rotation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at one of the things we develop expectations for both obviously the international versus U.S. Currently, our expectations for international, even though these are long-term expectations, are slightly higher than U.S. A lot of, generally, they've been similar; they're almost the same. So we actually believe that because they've underperformed over the long term, we believe that they'll essentially catch up to what's happened in the U.S. Now, is that going to happen over the next year? No, these are 20-year forecasts. We think there's going to be a slight tailwind to the international. That view is, I would say, consistent with a lot of international or global equity managers who do these kind of projections of saying, they like international kind of from a pure valuation perspective. The U.S. is a little pricier than non-U.S., so just because of that, they believe that there's more opportunities, there's more room for upside in those markets. I think they would also say that, given the current environment, there's more risk there too. But that's with risk, with opportunity there is usually more risk.
The currency issue also is relevant. I guess one could argue the opposite, say, well, why not invest in multinational U.S.-based companies that have exposure to these different regions, global regions? And certainly that is an attractive place to potentially invest, but the currency issue is a headwind, a big, large headwind for these U.S.-based countries to the tune of roughly 10%+ right now. And that is a zero-sum game. So that headwind is a tailwind for foreign based companies that are working in some of these regions. So we think it's attractive.
So this would be a good topic for our asset liability study.
Absolutely a good topic.
How much international loss have we experienced because of currency?
Well, that's a bit of a riddle of a question, because to gauge the actual impact of currency fluctuations, there's second, third, higher derivative level research that require on that. But our positions are hedged to a certain extent. And so we have, not amongst the managers, so they're bringing these returns back to dollars.
they're not completely 100% hedged, but they are, there's a large portion of the portfolio, international portfolio, that is hedged.
If you look at the currency portion of relative, you know, or looked at a hedge benchmark or the currency movements over the last year, it's been roughly a 10%. That's kind of a number I put that is kind of about 10% on average. So if you have just the local market returns for outside the U.S., it'd be 10% less than what you got as a dollar-based investor.
But even with hedged investments, currencies matter. It definitely plays a role on buying and selling goods. Bottom line. So taking this conversation into kind of where the portfolio responded for the quarter, page two, the top bullet point shows the total deposit fund returning 2.7% in the fourth quarter of 2012. This is the policy index by about 20 basis points. It's still ranked in the 17th percentile among other public funds above $1 billion in assets under management. For the quarter, positive contributors included our passive managers provided 10 basis points, Mellon and Russell Growth, the S&P 500 Index Fund and the Russell 1000 Growth Index, 10 basis points apiece. Jackson Square, a very strong quarter, gave most of that back here in the month of January, but for the quarter returned 210 basis points of outperformance versus the Russell 1000 Growth as a function of some of their healthcare and consumer staple stocks. The 1000 Value Index Fund, roughly in line. And Pyramus providing about 150 basis points of outperformance, while the strategy was down 2.3%, that outperformed its index, which was down 3.8%. When we look at the composite of the direct lending portfolio, it is starting to bear fruits and outperform that 9% net hurdle, 120 basis points we've seen coming out of the quarter on a time-weighted basis. Page three, these look at detractors, Dodge and Cox, done well in the last 5 years, stubbed its toe in the fourth quarter, down roughly 230 basis points relative to its index, the 1,000 value. Legato and Cap Prospect also trailing. Legato down 100 basis points to the small cap index, yet still outperforming the median manager ranking in the 40th percentile, whereas Cap Prospect's down short term 200 basis points to its index over longer 3 and 5 year periods. As we got the chance to see from both Marilyn and Liz, been a very successful partner for the plan. LSV trailing its index 70 basis points, ranking in 60th percentile amongst U.S. value managers over longer term periods, 3 years, in particular outperforming its index by 100 basis points. And Dodge & Cox moving to the fixed income sector, trailing its index down 50 basis points, down 30 to the median manager over the quarter. But again, longer periods done quite well. PIMCO has been benchmark-like since inception, trailing slightly for the quarter. And then the passive U.S. real estate index fund trailing its index around 10 basis points. Let's go ahead and skip pages 4 and 5. We'll kind of look at asset allocation on the monthly page and go to page 6, look at longer period performance. So we mentioned up top, we looked at the composite fund returning 2.7% for the quarter. But it's fair to note, as John Rick and I were discussing, the value of peer rankings and whether it's something to associate too much value to. But when it comes to the total fund, that really shines through the asset allocation decisions that we've made. And we're proud of this performance, both on an absolute, relative, and universe peer comparisons. We look over the 1, 2, 3, and 5 year periods, total fund generating that far column, the far right column, 10.6% versus the policy index, 9.8%, in the top decile of its peers. We're very proud of that. That's something to take time and highlight. As far as the usage of peer rankings, we continue to do it from a manager standpoint. It's a tool that we use to be able to gauge the decisions that we make and also the decisions the managers make as far as their portfolio against a select universe of its peers. Looking further into this page, I'll just highlight a couple different things. You see Jackson Square had a really strong quarter, 6.9% compared to Russell 1000, 4.8%, and the 10th percentile. percentile there, and really done well the last 5 trillion year periods. This is it's a very positive manager. We're pleased with that relationship. The rest of the managers are Dodger Cox, let's highlight that one. A really tough quarter and a tough month of January, which we'll see some of their bets and other concentrated portfolio at the top end. Stub against toe, but over the longer periods, done quite well. We look at 2, 3, 5-year periods on a relative and absolute basis. Page 7 goes ahead and looks at our small cap managers up top. We got on Cap Prospects. Got a deep dive into Cap Prospects, so I won't spend too much time there. Legato, benchmark-like, kind of across the board on a net basis, less impressive. This is something that we're going to, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, so we're going to continue to look and follow the progress here. We have an on-site scheduled for at SAS to take a look at Legato on March 13th, and we'll have a report thereafter, which we'll look forward to sharing with the plan. International managers, LSV and Pyramus. These managers are tracked to the MSCI ACWI ex-US index, or core index. However, LSV and Pyramus themselves have a value and growth tilt. We've talked about why we do this, why we don't have a direct index tracking those managers in particular relative to their style, something we might want to revisit. But the universe comparison, you'll see, it's kind of misleading, and we want to highlight that better next time. But the universe comparisons are relevant to their style. So Pyramus is relevant to growth style, LSV is relevant to value style. But the combination of the both is representative to the broader ACWI ex-US index. Over longer periods, added value, ranking above that 50% median performance. Page 8 looks at our fixed income managers, Dodge and Cox. Tough quarter, but done well over longer periods, very similarly to their equity counterpart. PIMCO, as mentioned, outperforming slightly when it comes to the Barclays Aggregate Index, but we'd like to see more out of them and continuing to monitor their progress there. The combination of the two created a very successful U.S. fixed income composite, providing trailing 1 year outperformance, slightly around 20 basis points, but over longer periods of 3 year, 210 basis points, 200 flat, and over the 5 year period, 120 basis points of relative outperformance. Real estate accounts on that, very strong in direct lending. These are time-weighted returns, but we're starting to see that really contribute to the bottom line and beat its net hurdle of 9% annually over that 1 year period. Let's flip quickly to page 9. This is a different view of what we already talked about, but it's the far right column that offers a slightly longer time horizon period, the 10-year period, and we can see how the total fund has done its policy index against the peer universe, again, quite well, 7% against the policy index, so 6.5, 17% next to the Page 10, this looks at the one-quarter attribution of the fund. Just to highlight a little bit how we go through this. When we talk about returns, we talk about how does this manager beat its benchmark? But that's not the only consideration when we think about attribution or what's contributing to excess returns. The other very powerful component is allocation. What is the sizing of this investment towards our policy? And so if you see, we have three columns in particular, the selection effect, allocation effect, and the interaction effect. Those three columns add up each line item to the total effects. And that added up to the bottom, that's where we get to the bottom for the quarter, down 15 basis points. Selection effect, reminder, that is, do they pick the right stocks or securities? Allocation effect, have we over or underweighted the sector appropriately? And their action effect is a catch-all, kind of capturing the trading between the two, selection and asset allocation. Just wanted to comment on that because this page can be confusing, but it is important that we present it the way it is to be transparent and representative of what actually took place over the board.
I would say a simple way to think of this, selection effect is what the managers did. Okay. Allocation effect is kind of what you've done.
Or we've done.
Yeah, or we've done. By where the portfolio is positioned right over this period. So hopefully that number usually is pretty small because you're trying to keep the portfolio. You're not doing this
consciously saying, I'm trying to outperform because I'm doing this or doing that. You're trying, so you're trying to take as little risk as possible and keep the portfolio in line with targets and policies and like that. So that's a number you typically want to see pretty small.
So the last two pages, we're gonna jump a little bit through the rest of this book, and I'm only gonna highlight the lead pages on the individual asset classes. For your own reading pleasure at night, please delve into this and look at the individual managers' top holdings, top contributors, top detractors. I'm gonna just speak to kind of market characteristics. So page 11, we've had Liz and Marilyn kind of talk to the equity markets a little bit, and this is another perspective on that. The main takeaways are that U.S. equity markets have been the place to be over the last year, 2014, and we've seen around a one-year return of 12.6% for the Russell 3000. The main sectors providing negative returns are the energy sectors, and really that was the only sector for the trailing year that provided negative absolute return. And then the three strong drivers of positive absolute return: healthcare, infotech, and utilities. Energy falling roughly 13% for the quarter, and overall Russell 3 rising around 5% for the quarter. It's been a really good place to invest U.S. stocks. As Rick highlighted, maybe thinking about rotating to a certain extent might be an intelligent thing to consider. Let's jump all the way, if there are any questions, let's jump all the way to page 38. We'll take a look at the bond markets. This is going to hark back to some of our initial comments on page 1 and 2. But disinflation and geopolitical risk continue to boost the demand for treasuries. We've seen that index rise roughly 2% for the fourth quarter. When we look back over 2014, the place to be for long-dated treasuries. They outperform. They look like a very smart place to be with those securities with over 10 years in duration, rising over 5.6% for the quarter, over 17% for the year. At lunch, I went ahead and I took a look at where different countries' 10 years were trading. The U.S. trading around 2%. You say that's just very low, historic lows. It's true. When we look at it against the relative options, the U.K. presently trading at 1.8%. France's 10-year treasury trading at 0.7%. In Germany, its 10-year note trading at 0.3%. When you look at the different places to place your money, the U.S. doesn't seem that bad anymore at 1.99 or 2%. That, or simply getting out of the asset class and moving into something like equities. That is the intent of policymakers standing in the Eurozone today. They want to drive assets out of these harbors that are providing really a 0% return into other assets. Predominantly, they want them into riskier assets, equity. And so this is a, when you look at a relative basis, a massive divergence between what you get. I don't have Italy and Spain in there, but Italy and Spain give you less return than the United States of America for a 10-year note. Something's, no offense, but something's not balanced when you think about the security of your capital, the return that you're getting. So we expect there to be some implications in the markets to react, maybe slowly, but this is some important data I thought helpful
now,
to share.
Hasn't there been some change in this since the first of the year?
Yeah, the stats I just gave you were stats that I pulled from at lunch today. So that was real time where the markets are at this year. The theme is still intact. So flipping, no other comments or questions, let's flip that to page 39. Just quickly, this looks at our fixed income portfolio. Let's actually not spend too much time here because we've already looked at these perspectives just a couple pages back. Looks at our portfolio peer rankings. Let's go to page 42. This is the last page I'll stop on, but this looks at both currency issues and the yield curve. Up top, currency, we have the QE happening with the European Central Bank. And then the decline observed by major market currencies, the euro, the yen, the pound, many of which have fallen over 10% relative to the US dollar, it has had major implications. Two in particular, pain felt by US multinationals. I commented on that already. And I've also commented on the second point I was going to make, and is that
the repricing of real assets. Maybe more specifically, as I've already highlighted, it might make sense, real estate. There are real assets that foreign investors will want to purchase that have different values and deeper values than just simply a return. The diversification available to them, the security of their dollar, and also the return are really going to drive pricing. We very well could be in a period where we could see real assets start to increase in their price. And that's something that we've been ahead of. We've been making decisions at this board to get exposure to real assets and benefit from that potential trend coming down the pike. And lastly, just looking at the yield curve. This is a very boring chart, but a very important chart, and a lot of the world makes decisions based upon the structure of the yield curve. The yellow curve is what we look at as of December 31st, 2014, and the blue curve is where it was a year ago. And you can see the far end of the curve, or the far right of that chart, it has come down a lot. That is a function of the returns I mentioned, 17% return on long-dated securities really benefiting from this flattening the yield curve. And it's ever so slightly, but you can see the yellow line rise above the blue and red over the short period, in between the 0 and 5 year to maturity. And to Jim's point, the market is expecting, to some extent, the Fed to tighten sooner than later. When the Fed tightens, that affects the short part of the curve more dramatically. The long part, in particular, is a function of the markets. And the markets will take it where they deem fit. Okay, I think I drank a full bottle of water while giving that presentation. So. Questions?
The Wall Street Journal said you shouldn't overhydrate.
What?
That's what they're saying.
That's not what my grandma said.
When you're running a marathon.
Oh.
What does that mean?
Overhydrating.
Really fast, item 7B. This is something, well, the report is Stancer Investment Managers peer ranking. And when we were drawing up the agenda last week, I asked Kathy why we always put this in consent. She said she didn't really know. We've just been doing that. So I said, well, let's either get rid of it or let's bring it out of consent so we all take a look at it. So anyway, we stuck it under SIS. I don't really have anything to say. It's fairly self-explanatory unless you want to say something about it.
We commented on top. From a manager level, we use it as a tool we'll get to in the manager's monitoring program, but it's a different gauge. Track performance. We like it when the numbers are lower than higher. And over longer periods, this plan has done quite well.
You know, one thing I've found very interesting is that our total fund, that first page, we ranked 17th, but we lost 100 basis points to the benchmark. So that means the benchmark beat a lot of managers.
It did. Now, a couple things, which I would like to spend some time on over the next few months, but part of our policy index, or our benchmark, are benchmarks that we can't go out and invest in. You know, our direct lending benchmark, net 9%, that sounds fantastic, but we can't go out and buy net 9%. We could, we should, I should be unemployed, we all should invest in that. I mean, that would be where we go. You know, we have those hard hurdles, but we can't invest in those things. And those exist in the real estate sector, there's other benchmarks that are flawed. So we don't shy away from a tough bogey, but not realistic.
And that's one of the things about a valid benchmark, is it has to be best investable.
Right? And I'd like to potentially consider alternatives.
All right, you're up with 7C.
This is the manager monitor report. A couple things to highlight that there should be caveats as we have been looking at both Pyramus and Legato as far as their standing is concerned. Before I comment on that further, for the most part, all of our managers are in good standing, provided alpha and peer rankings that have been quite strong. The PIMCO note, we have a no under the organizational continuity. Obviously, this is a function of Bill Gross, and we're starting to see headlines wane a bit. It went from news to drama to gossip. And hopefully, that's the gossip part is the tail end of this, and we can kind of evaluate the manager for the talent that exists, which there's a ton of very capable people there, and check their performance above the benchmark, ideally going forward. I mentioned that we're going to be doing an on-site for Legato. There's some things we want to make sure that we communicate to you, but I'll hold comments until that takes place. And then Pyramus in particular, we've done some work there as well with the fees. I don't know if it's now time to talk about any updates, Rick, that we want to speak to as far as fees are concerned. And
We can talk about that in the value added.
Okay.
That's a good time.
Good. Next up is looking at January.
Said.
Okay, well, we kicked the year off to a bad start. I don't mean to plan, the market's down, the Russell 3 down 2.78% for the month of January. Some look at January as a bellwether, as January goes, so does the rest of the year. I don't know. I don't necessarily buy that. Sounds intriguing, but we'll let the rest of the year speak for itself.
Yeah, we might as well talk about the Super Bowl.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Super Bowl, exactly. But the thing that was kind of clear for the month was that growth outperformed value, or at least was a place that provided. We see that in the Russell 1000 style indices, the 1000 growth down 1.53%, the value was down 4%. And that was the case also in the small caps, the value down 4.1%, the growth down roughly half of that, 2.28%. Of particular note is to look at the continuation in both REITs, real estate investment trusts, and commodities. REITs, a very, very strong month, 6.69%. We're seeing just the combination of lower rates, sustained rates on the global platform, drive valuations. I don't want to comment on bubble like or anything like that just yet, but when you look at the 1 year column of the US REIT, up 35% for the year. And that 10-year column, an annual return of 9.84%, that completely captures 2008 and 2009. And so even with all of that pain that was felt, when we look at it from just a data point, you can't even see it in the trend, really. When you see the 5-year to 7-year and it drops off from 20% return to 9, well, something happened. We all know what it was. But it looks really good all the way out. Commodities. This is not just oil, but a lot of other commodities, mining, precious metals, have been hammered over the course of the past year, down 5% for the month, trailing year, down roughly 20%. I think it was yesterday, the day before, the U.S. is doing some investigation, the top 20 firms that generally control the precious metal market. So here we go again as far as nefarious activities are concerned. We'll see how that plays out. Gold also having a very strong bump for the month, up 6.5%, probably a function of more quantitative easing. We see there to be an inverse relationship, a positive relationship between quantitative easing and the price of gold. When we look at the non-US markets, we see a reverse of trend. The EFI, or the developed world, non-US, that stands for Europe, Africa, and Far East of the developed world, up 50 basis points, and the emerging markets up 61 basis points. This is a reverse of trend. Kind of speaks to the point we made previously, as you see asset rotation and much more attractive values in those parts of the world. We see a continuing trend with the currencies in the last three sections of this particular category. The euro down 6.74%, and the pound down just under 4%. This is a race to the bottom. We'll see where a new normal sets in, but there are certainly divergences in this world, and we haven't even talked about the Swiss franc. Not necessarily relevant, but that was a major market mover when that country took the peg off the euro, and it destroyed hedge funds and alternative assets, and we saw a lot of assets, a lot of money just disappear overnight from major bets against that currency. With the fixed income, the Barclays had a very strong month, up 2.1% for the month. We saw that number, positive returns, pretty strong all across the fixed income spectrum as equity struggles. So we'll go ahead and look at page 2. This looks at the asset levels of our managers and how it relates to the current policy. International equities, fixed income, right on target. And we have a real estate and direct lending under target, and that balance is being held in domestic equities, which has been a positive tailwind to total fund performance, which John highlighted to you. Look at the attribution table. Continue to move towards that target coming months. Some of the real estate
question
made. Yes, Joan.
What was the total value of the portfolio on the 31st of December versus what it was on the 31st of January?
Great question.
The dollar amount.
It would be $1,795,731,000. There's been a $27 million change over the months, a net negative change. So
27?
27.3 million. And on page three, we get a sense for that change over the month, but also over the prior year, so a month, 12 months, as of January 31st, the plan net appreciated value roughly 90 million or 89.8 million, a 5.35% change, and that's net contributions, or excuse me, benefits from prior year. So we get to page four, five, and six. This looks at the fund, and it was ugly. It's not a positive month. When we look at the total fund down about 1.4% for the month, but each of the managers, on a relative basis, did not do well. Obviously, the passive managers returning as we would expect. Jackson Square down 3.16% for the month, which is around 1.6% lower than the index. Dodgecock likewise, excuse me, down 5.5% for the month versus its index of 4%, 1.5% different. Cap Prospects, Legato, Benchmark Life. Also, the trend continues with our international managers, slightly trailing their respective indexes, or their, their actual index. Fixed income providing a positive return, 1.56%, but trailing the ag. Dodge & Cox has a heavy overweight in corporates and duration bets, and that has been a tailwind over longer periods, but last month it was not received well. But we saw PIMCO provide an absolute return, pretty strong, 1.96%. The Barclays Ag really shined, and it trailed at 2.1% for the Barclays Ag. Real estate doing fantastic. We're happy that we're kind of building up that allocation. Greenfield American Realty that hasn't hit returns yet, but the REIT, passive REIT return is strong, 6.7%. And direct lending, this return is kind of meaningless for the month, but we'll have more accurate visibility of the next quarter.
So we have 3 days left in the month. Do you have any predictions for February?
It's not been bad.
Hit a new high today.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. We're back at a really great month for growth assets, and we have a lot of those. So, should be good. So what is January now? As January, so is the year. We'll see. February might have. It has a response. The next report is the top 10. I can fly through this. If there's any company particularly want me to comment on, I can either say have an answer or say I don't know. The latter is probably more accurate. Outside of kind of the blue chip stocks. Growth, you look at the top 10, five up, five down on a relative basis, very similar to value. Value on the next page, actually doing even better. Seven of the top 10 on a relative basis are providing positive outperformance versus its benchmark, Russell 1000 value. And we see that trend continue over to the S&P 500, seven out of 10 stocks up versus down on a relative basis. Dodge & Cox, 8 out of 10, so strong snapback for Dodge & Cox. Hopefully that, we'll see that come through in their report with the rest of the portfolio. Jackson Square up next, 6 out of 10, positive, although Celgene, which has been their Trojan horse for returns, down pretty significantly on a relative basis, 8% through the half point of the month. We'll see how things shape out the rest of the year. Cap Prospects, Legato. About half and half, five up, six up. And then our international managers, we'll see how it goes. The top 10, only three out of the top 10 were positive. However, both managers, the top 10 holdings is not very influential to the rest of their strategy returns. So we'll be on the lookout and see how they're doing. That was a lot. Hopefully, this was helpful and provided a deep dive into where we stand after January and at the end of the year. We had a lot of important decisions here, a lot of which really we're proud of. Never satisfied, but proud of at large, kind of where this fund is standing looking at 2015, which has a lot of strategic initiatives that we think have extreme value, and we're excited to partner the best we can going forward, and it will be a busy year.
Thank you. Mr. Executive Director.
Okay, item 8A, 2014 quarter four value added and cash flow report. This is an informational item only. As we've been hearing for the last half hour, quarter four was a pretty bad month on a relative basis, value added basis for the fund. Active fixed income and equity managers lost a total of $5.7 million. Jackson Square and Pyramus added 5.3, but the other managers gave back approximately $11 million in value. So that adds up to the $5.7 million lost relative to a passive investment. Nate already talked about the reasons why for most of the ones that were in the negative. On a five-year basis, all active fixed income and equity managers have added value except Dodge & Cox Equity and Legato Capital. Dodge & Cox Equity had been above water until just last quarter, but as Nate said earlier, they had a fairly atrocious quarter at the end of 2014, so that has put them back underwater for the last 5 years. Over the total five-year period, however, the fund has added $40 million relative to a pure passive investment. So we're still very much way ahead of the game in terms of active versus passive investing. On our fee summary, quarter over quarter, the managerial fees have remained pretty much unchanged. Custodial fees, however, showed a considerable decrease from the prior quarter, but that's mainly due to the fact that last quarter was the first bill we got from our new custodian bank, and there were a lot of transitional costs embedded in that bill, so I wouldn't read too much into the quarter over quarter change in the custodial fees. On a long-term basis, manager fees are showing a slight downward trend. However, I want to let you know that this probably is transitory and is really a function of the performance fee schedules that we have set up with two of the managers. The way that they calculate these performance fees is that for three quarters of the year, we pay a small basis point asset under management fee. And then at the end of June, June 30th comes along, then they go back and they look at the relative performance over the last year, and we're either hit with this huge performance fee or there's nothing if they didn't outperform. So what you're going to see is that you're going to see managerial fees spike up for the second quarter of each calendar year, and then they're going to go back down. So I wouldn't count on this downward trend in manager fees that you're seeing in this report. Custodial fees, however, they are showing a downward trend, and I would expect that to continue. It's due entirely to the fact that we switched custodian banks. The fee structure that we were able to acquire from our new custodian bank is tremendously lower than what we had been paying in the past, and most of that decrease in the cost is due to the foreign exchange fees that are much, much lower than they were. So I would definitely anticipate and continue seeing that custodial fee trend downward over the long term, and we've already seen it over the short term as well. Cash flow report. The only thing we did different this quarter is that we've added, and I plan on doing this for each fourth quarter every year, is we added what the cash flows were for the entire year. And one of the interesting things that came out of that annual cash flow report is that it allows us to see how much money is actually coming out of the fund due to the cash shortfall that we have due to the fact that benefits paid are greater than the plan sponsor contributions that are coming in. And if you look at that last page on this report here, that cash flow report 2014, January 2014 through December 14, you'll see sale of investments of $34 million. That is a good approximation of our systematic shortfall that the system is currently under. So if you had a chance to look at the agenda item, one thing that simply popped into my mind was, well, with that I can tell, you know, whether employer contribution rates are adequate at this time. So if I take that $34 million and I divide it by the average portfolio value throughout the year, I get a number about 1.9%, I believe it was. In other words, the contribution shortfall represents about 1.9% of the total portfolio. So we're having to siphon 1.9% of assets off the actual portfolio each year as we go along. That means, on average, relative to the discount rate, the assets are increasing by about 5.9% per year. Our assets aren't increasing by the discount rate. They're increasing by the discount rate less the contribution shortfall, the siphoning of the assets off the portfolio. If you compare that 5.9% to the average growth rate of the liabilities, it's about 5.3%. So 60 basis points. So our assets are growing by about 60 basis points annually relative to the liabilities in the long run. So we are on a trajectory towards 100% funding, and obviously we're on a trajectory where we're closing the gap between assets and liabilities, which means the unfunded liability is theoretically going down. So given the difference between the growth in the assets and the growth in the liabilities, that tells me that plan sponsor contributions are adequate, at least at this time.
That's good.
And that's plan sponsor contributions and employee
contributions. I'm sorry, you're right. That's plan sponsored and employee contributions. You're absolutely correct. Good catch, Darren.
Rick, what happens, what's the stress test if we lose 5% in 2015?
We can definitely do that, and like I think we talked about this very briefly at the last meeting, we're on tap for next year is to every quarter to have a presentation that shows what the sensitivity is to investment returns, what the sensitivity of the funded ratio is, and employer contributions going forward. It's a very, very good question to ask, and it's something that I think most pension systems don't spend enough time on during the year. In fact, I don't ever remember going out and talking about that stuff. But I think it's a good idea that we all know what the risks are that we face. And when I say risk, I mean especially risks to the employer contribution rate and the funded ratio of the system. And with an analysis like that, we should be able to get a really good idea of the pressures that we face. And we can even do some scenario analyses too, given with some help from our friends at the end of the table there. All right, item 8B, this is something new. I've had a couple requests from board members to put this information out on a regular basis. So beginning this quarter, we're going to stick this out every quarter. I don't have much to say on this. The only thing that's very interesting, if you look at the report for White Oak, the very first one, you can look at anyone if you like, but I'm just opening this to the very first one, which is White Oak. We keep the running total of all the actual cash flows that we make to these investments in terms of capital calls and distributions. And with the exact dates of these calls and distributions and the size of these cash flows, we can come up with an internal rate of return. And so you can see what the actual internal rate of return is at the lower right of each of those reports that we have for each of our direct lenders. And you can see that White Oak has an internal rate of return since inception of almost 9%, Medley 3.7%, and Raven 6.1%, which maybe Nate can comment on this. I think at this point in time, we haven't been in these investments that long, and it seems to me, and I'm not an expert at this, it seems to me at this point in time to have those types of returns are pretty decent at this time, and I would expect them to continue to go up.
Yeah.
Since all the funds except White Oak are closed, and we should just be getting money back at this point in time.
We should expect that the harvest, if you will, to increase over the next few years as they put a certain amount of money to work that has been locked up for a duration, 2, 4, 5 years, what have you. It's going to come back, and it should come back at a higher clip, which will drive up that IRR. But the fact that there's a positive IRR to any extent is a healthy indication.
So I think as a group here, I think that we should feel reasonably pleased with the results that I see, at least from the returns on the direct lending portfolio. And that's all I have.
I think it's important to note that the direct lending reports are a full quarter behind.
Yes.
And it's just that it takes that long to get all the information. And they are doing it according to their agreements. It's just that much farther behind.
Jake? according to Fred. We don't have anything in closed session. But that takes us to the member forum.
Nothing for me.
Pass.
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 Nothing for me.
Pass back.
Good.
Yesterday, President Obama announced in the AARP meeting that the retirement contributions or investments, the regulations are going to be changed. But you know, he was speaking at the AARP meeting. So to what extent we will be covered regarding these changes that he is expecting or he's going to announce next month?
Did you catch when whether they apply to public funds or whether they were just private? No?
It is AARP.
Private, primarily the 401k,
okay.
457 in the private market.
Okay.
It's because they're totally different rules than what we right. operate under. Basically, they're wanting to impose what we operate under, which is the fiduciary model. To all
itch to go
of those yes. industries. Of course,
see.
They're pushing back.
Me too.
Okay,
very good.
I have nothing else to add.
Okay, with that, we're adjourned.